Good evening, good morning, wherever you may be. I am Dave Schrader, and I'm your host tonight for the next 4 hours. This evening, we're going to explore time travel, alternate realities, parallel universes, deja vu, time slips, items out of time, UFOs, ghosts, false memories, near death, remote viewing, and how it all may relate to one another. Now, I'm going to ask you to open your minds and consciousness to the possibilities of the theories, ideas, claims, and beliefs that we'll discuss tonight. I'm not asking you to believe. I'm simply requesting that you consider what might be, what could be, and the what if of the topic. Now, throughout the night, we will be visited by experts in UFO, near-death experiences, remote viewing, the paranormal, and a self-proclaimed time traveler. Is time travel and communicating with our past or future nothing more than flight of fancy? Is it science fiction and fantasy fair? Or is proof of it around us daily? Like that moment of deja vu when you know you've experienced this moment before. UFOs have been viewed days leading up to and immediately following major world events. Is that a coincidence? Or are they time travelers visiting to witness history as it unfolds? How about that moment in a heightened sense of danger when time itself seems to slow to an unbelievable and amazingly clear pace? People around the world sharing vivid false memories. Are these forms of time travel and parallel universes? Well, I'm going to ask you to stay tuned with us this evening. William J. Burns and Joel Martin will be with us all night. We'll be back with the best in overnight talk radio. I'm Dave Schrader, and Coast to Coast AM returns right after this. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host for the evening, Dave Schrader. Joining me now and for the remainder of the show, my two guests, William J. Burns, the New York Times best-selling co-author of The Day After Roswell. He's also been the star of History Channel's UFO Hunters, Ancient Aliens, and Unsealed the Conspiracy Files. He's appeared on Good Morning America, Larry King Live, The Howard Stern Show, and is a regular contributor to Coast AM and my own show, Darkness Radio. Joel Martin also joins us. He's nationally recognized as a paranormal expert and best-selling author. And since the early 1970s, Joel has been a radio talk show host. And as a TV talk show host, he won the Cable Ace Award. As an investigative reporter about the paranormal and psychic phenomena, he discovered internationally renowned medium George Anderson and exposed the Amityville Horror as a hoax. Joel is a network TV consultant about the paranormal and has made many TV appearances. We're lucky enough to have both of these gentlemen throughout the 4 hours. Bill, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here this evening.
Hi, thanks, Dave. Good to be here.
You know, you and I have had an opportunity on my show to talk on every type of topic from UFOs to serial killers and anything in between, and you always deliver the goods for me. And it was interesting when we talked about a month ago about time slips and time phenomena. You brought up a great idea. You said, you know, if we're going to do this and we're going to talk on Coast, I think that we should include Joel Martin in the interview, as he has quite an extensive knowledge of the paranormal and near-death experiences. And I thought this would be kind of an interesting perspective as we go through the night tonight to talk to near-death expert, a UFO expert, a remote viewer, a time traveler, everything that can be combined into this topic. I want to start off by asking you first, and then we'll talk to Joel as well. I know that you've done a lot of research in many different topics. Where do you stand on the belief of time travel? Do you believe that it does exist currently?
I think it does. I think that at some point in the future, that civilization has developed a method of time travel. And I think that some of the anomalies that we're experiencing now, and there are anomalies, are the result of people interfering with our timeline for one of another reasons. I think one of the most important statements, at least that influenced me, was made by one of the founders of the German rocket program, the Nazi rocket program, Hermann Oberth, who came to the United States under Operation Paperclip. And when Philip Corso, who I wrote the book Day After Roswell with, when Philip Corso was stationed at Red Canyon, which is the Army missile test range section of Red Sands, White Canyon, I'm sorry, Red Canyon at White Sands. Corso out in the desert claimed that he saw the strange glistening object on the ground. He thought it was a spaceship, maybe. He didn't know what it was. And he saw this from the plane that he was flying over the range with. Landed back at the base, then grabbed the staff car, drove out into the desert where this thing was, and it was kind of shimmering in the sunlight. He said it was a brutally hot day in New Mexico. And he went out there, and he was looking at it, and it was shimmering, and just for some reason, he thought, I'm going to touch the surface of this thing. And he touched it, and to his shock, it was ice cold. Now, this is a brutally hot day, and the thing is like it's pulsing with a light, an internal light. And then it disappeared right before his eyes. So he got back to the base, and he spoke to Herman Oberth, who was one of the people involved in Army research and development. And he said he thought he saw a spaceship. And Herman Oberth, who was the guy who made the statement publicly about the Nazi rocket program, saying, "We were helped by people from other worlds." That's a stunning statement to be making back in the late 1940s and early 1950s. And Herman Oberth told him, "No, it probably wasn't a spaceship. It was a time ship." And from that point on, that really changed his attitude. And it changed mine, too, because somehow the Germans, even back in the 1940s, seemed to think that time travel was possible. And they were the ones that developed this artillery-shaped object called the Bell, the Wonder Weapon, which disappeared, literally disappeared from view as the Soviet Army was advancing in Poland toward the end of World War II.
Joel, you've researched and reported on the strange and supernatural for many years. You look at things like ghosts and psychic phenomena, paranormal, time travel. Does that fit into this realm as being a possibility and a believability to you, or is this just too far out there to actually exist?
No, it's not that far out at all. I hesitate to say I believe in it, because it's not even a belief. It's just a matter of knowing and feeling and sensing that it's so. No, it is not that far out there at all. The last thing I read about it was kind of interesting, was the Michio Kaku book about future of some of this phenomena, and it talked about the possibility of time travel. So that's a concept that's gained a good deal of favor now with scientists, in addition to which there are those of us, including myself, who've had experiences that you might call that, because if I go to a particular location, or particular locations, I should say, and they represent a certain period in history, the deja vu I experience is so strong that I can swear to you I'd been there before, and I have no reason to lie. I have no horse in the race to say it's real or it's not real. I get the same paycheck with it or without it. That's why I could debunk the Amityville Horror with my colleague Steve Kaplan at the time, and that's why I could say George Anderson was the greatest medium I ever met. It's a matter of it being more than possible. I think it is genuine. You remember that for a long time, they used to call clairvoyance that ability to go into the future and to see what was going on someplace else. They would call it traveling clairvoyance. And traveling clairvoyance was just another word for seeing ahead. And I watched experiments where it was done. And having seen those experiments and having my own deja vus, I absolutely, positively am sure it exists, whether we can explain it or not.
Joining us now for the remainder of this hour is a gentleman with a unique perspective on time travel. In 2004, Andrew Bisciago made a very controversial announcement publicly, claiming that from the time he was 7 to around the age of 12, he participated in Project Pegasus, a secret U.S. government program that he said worked on teleportation and time travel under the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA. During the time, Mr. Bisciago said that he experienced 8 different time travel technologies, Mostly, he said, his travel involved a teleporter based on technical papers supposedly found in the pioneering mechanical engineer Nikola Tesla's New York City apartment after his death in January of 1943. Joining us for this hour is time traveler Andrew Bishago. Andy, thank you very much for being here with us this evening, sir. Andy, are you there? Well, we might be having some connection problems. We'll have Gina and Brian take a look at that, see if we can get into it. Now, I'm sure that both of you gentlemen have heard the story Andrew Bishago has been talking about and his experiences. We know that the government certainly has shadow operatives and shadow agencies that are working in different fields at all times. Do you believe that our government, in fact, has found a way to time travel and that we're keeping this information to ourselves, or do you think that this is a global phenomenon that many different countries have the ability to do? And maybe we can start with you on that, Bill.
Well, I think that our government has, in fact, figured some of this out. I think that DARPA has done research projects. We are probably 25 to 30 years in advance. This is secretly, black budgetly, to coin a word. We're probably 25 to 30 years in advance of where we think we are. I mean, there are projects that were going on, and of course, Joe could talk to this too. There were projects going on, this is even before DARPA, at the very end of World War II, that were really quite advanced, some of which were based on experiments that were done in Germany and in Poland in the 1940s, but some of which are ideas that go all the way back to the end of the 19th century with people like Helena Blavatsky, the founder of theosophy. So, yes, I do believe the government has experimented with this, and I know for a fact that there are ways that even individuals that are not connected with the government, that Joe, myself, anybody even listening to the show, can find ways at least mentally to travel forward in time and literally see the future about certain people. And we worked on that with George Norrie with a book called Worker in the Light.
All right, joining us now online, Andrew Bishago is here with us. Andrew is a participant in this project, a project that I'm guessing the government wanted to keep secret. You're now out exposing and talking about this. You've made this kind of a passion play for you that you've been able to try to get this out there. You want disclosure to come forward. If this is such a revered and protected technology, why do you feel the importance of bringing it forward? And are you worried at all for your own safety by doing this?
Well, let me answer the last question first. I'm clearly in danger by becoming a whistleblower regarding the U.S. time-space capability. I'm not worried about it because if you fret about the outcome of the implementation of your destiny or your life's mission, as it were, then you put yourself that much farther from achieving it. So I've decided to simply carry forward my truth campaign in a fearless way so that I can implement it. Now, we're not talking about one technology. Project Pegasus had 8 different forms of quantum access, fully operational by 1970. And I was exposed to that firsthand as one of the child participants. And I'm talking about everything for the broad gamut of quantum access consists of, on the rudimentary side, let's say over on the far left, remote viewing. Then through several advanced forms of remote viewing, for example, spinning to induce out-of-body experiences, the Montauk chair. In the middle, we have physio-virtual forms of time travel, such as provided by chronovisors, whether you're using it as a remote viewing device or whether you're encompassed by the hologram. Ultimately, the chronovisors became time machines because we were going to the locations that they were tuning in the past and future. And then ultimately, by 1970, the program had several forms of physical time travel. Okay, we were teleporting as early as 1968. My first teleporting to New Mexico took place, we believe, in February of 68. By summer of 1970, they were training the children to jump from the Curtis Wright Building in Woodridge, New Jersey, to the Santa Fe State Capitol grounds, and we would get back to New Jersey via an identical Tesla teleporter at the Sandia National Labs outside of Albuquerque. And then during those developmental years that I was exposed to, let's say 70 to 72, they had developed advanced teleporters that they were calling stargates, and another form of physical time travel known as plasma confinement, where you create a radioactive plasma field around the teleportee, and they were using that to open up a wormhole and drop us into the past. Then ultimately the teleporters were sending us as far as 2045 from 1972. So I'm speaking out not to promote mass time travel. I'm of the view that time travel is a precious technology, and it would be folly to introduce it publicly, because mass time travel by mass people on mass timelines would produce mass chaos. I do think we should carry on covert operations in that area of technical activity within the military and the intel community. But the primary reason I'm speaking out, Dave, is because the Tesla teleportation technology that the project developed and reduced to practice and made it safe by 1970 is one of the technologies that we're going to have to implement to literally rescue our civilization from the kind of society that we'll have if we don't implement it, which would be will be a society of 24-lane freeways. I mean, we're already reaching build-out in many many of our watersheds, many of our major urban realms. And I believe that teleportation is going to enable us to decongest society and not have to live through that dystopic reality that we'll have if we don't implement it. So my ultimate political purpose is to bear witness to what happened and say, wait a minute, our fathers and grandfathers' generation developed a revolutionary form of transport, one that was already operational at the time that Albert Gore was studying the greenhouse effect at Harvard College as an undergraduate. And we need to bring it forward, use it to address climate change, because, of course, human transport produces 60% of the greenhouse gases that are going to affect climate, and already are. And so that's why I'm speaking out, because we need to go back and rescue that teleportation technology and use it to literally save our civilization.
Joel, let me ask you this. As a reporter and journalist and somebody that's gone out and looked at the way the world is, one thing that we can pretty much say about human race is that we're kind of a destructive race. And whenever one of us has a superiority over the other, we flex that muscle. If time travel was available through our government, do you think that they could literally use it without destroying us and folding us in? Because, I don't know, I just think the arrogance and egos of politicians and the way our government runs, if we had time travel truly available to us, I can't see how we're not in a constant state of chaos and things folding and collapsing on us all the time.
I happen to agree with you about that. Without getting into too many details, I think Bill probably recalls who the individual is I'm speaking about. After the passing of somebody who was quite well known as an industrialist in this country and had a secret passion for parapsychology and research of the kinds of things we're talking about here, I came upon some of the notebooks I was given to look at. I couldn't take any with me. I couldn't copy any, but I was allowed to look at them. And it was fascinating to see that there were secret meetings, that there were scientists and political individuals and people from every position of power who came together to talk about these things and to research them. And curiously, and I have always thought of it as no big surprise, a secret government. Because when you look at what the presidents have known or what the presidents know, you are told, and it's stated very clearly to me, it has been by military people many times, the president is on a need-to-know basis for just the reason you gave. They don't want too many people to know, and as your guest just said a moment ago, it would probably create mass chaos. I don't think the bulk of people are ready for it, but you can't even get it if you're the president of the United States, because I recall Bill Clinton trying to get some material about UFOs and was told, no, need-to-know basis. And the last president who probably got as close as you could get was maybe Dwight Eisenhower, because he had been in the military. No, we have done a good job of keeping what we want secret secret. I mean, you'll always hear somebody say, well, you know, if it was real, it couldn't be kept a secret all of this time. Look, I've studied President Lincoln's assassination now since I'm a young kid. And, you know, we still don't have the truth about that. And that's 1865. It has nothing to do with the paranormal. It's just the analogy that if you want to keep something secret, you really can keep something secret. And they have about this material. And when I read some of the notes and saw some of the names of the people, I was stunned. There's no question that they were looking to the laws of time and space to see what can be done about time travel, to see what can be done about false memories, about all kinds of alternate universe theories, things that...
Well, we have to take a quick break, Joel. Yeah. You brought up an interesting point about Abraham Lincoln. Our guest, Andrew Bishago, claims to have visited Ford Theater before the assassination and was there at the Gettysburg Address. We'll talk to him about those moments in time on Coast to Coast AM right after this. Isn't it about time you become a Coast to Coast insider? You can find the best in overnight talk radio and archives that plunge over 5 years deep. Thousands of shows and some of the most amazing topics for around 15 cents a day. It's real easy. Just go to coasttocoastam.com, click on the Insider tab, and you'll find all the information there. Aside from the archive shows, you also get a chance for monthly chats with George Norrie and other hosts of Coast to Coast AM. You also get a chance to hear from some of the top guests featured right here on a nightly basis. There's news, there's information, and more, and it's at a great low price. Go sign up now. Become a Coast Insider before time runs out on you. Our guests for the evening, William Burns, Joel Martin, and Andrew Bishago, Washington State lawyer. Andrew Bishago, the leader of Project Pegasus, a quest started by Andrew as he served as a child participant in the U.S. Time-Space Exploration Program. Andrew wages truth and urges the U.S. government to disclose the time travel and teleportation technologies. He claims as a child, he was on site and has a photograph of himself at the Gettysburg Address and was there at the Ford Theater numerous times prior to the assassination of President Abraham Lincoln. When we return, we'll find out a little bit about that story. And I know that Bill Burns has some questions as well. That's all coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host for the evening, Dave Schrader. My guests, William Burns, Joel Martin, and in this hour, Andrew Bishago, the time-traveling attorney, is here with us. Andrew, we were speaking with Joel in the last segment. He said that he believes at this point we still don't know exactly what really went down with the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. I know that you've made claims that you were there at the Gettysburg Address and at Ford's Theater. What do you know? Do you believe that we do know the truth about that situation, or do you think that there is still things that are hidden this far into the future still that we'll never really know truthfully about?
Well, actually, that puts us on the vagary of what time travel permits us to do. I was sent to Ford's Theater, arriving April 14th, 1865, five or six times in the summer of 1971 as a nine-year-old via an advanced chronovisor that was at the Cerrillos Cultural Center Gymnasium. It was actually down the gymnasium up on the symphony orchestra-sized stage there. And I was sent to the muddy street outside the theater, and I was then instructed to walk in and talk my way past the table at the front door there where tickets were being received. However, every time I was sent there, small details of that same basic event would vary. So in a particular timeline, John Wilkes Booth may have shot Lincoln. In another, Mrs. Lincoln may have pulled her little one-shot Derringer out of her person and shot Father Abraham in the back of the head. In other words, the major events in history are deeply embedded in the various alternate adjacent timelines in the multiverse, but the details change. So what I was discovering when they were sending me there, in fact, a couple of times I heard the report of the shot of that killed Abraham Lincoln. Every night that I was sent there that summer, Lincoln was shot there that night, but the details were changing. And that really, I think, is a description of how these timelines relate in the multiverse. The closer you are to the same timeline, the less differentiation you have. And so what we really need to ask is, on our timeline, who shot Lincoln. And in fact, we don't know. We have no real eyewitness account that it was John Wilkes Booth. We just have him dropping to the stage from their balcony seating and yelling something. He supposedly yelled, "Sic semper tyrannis," which is a Latinism that means there goes the way of tyrants, as if he was boasting about the fact that he just killed the tyrant leading the Northern cause during the war. But we don't know because we don't have an eyewitness, and because when we use quantum access to access that event, at least when we did in the summer of 1971, the same basic event was happening, but it was constantly changing. I would go to the ticket table in the front of the theater, and there was a man selling the ticket or accepting the ticket from me, and his son was sitting next to him. The next time they would send me, just his son was sitting there receiving my ticket and so forth. A man would walk by talking to a lady, and then the next time they sent me, he would be talking to two ladies that he was walking with. So that's kind of the mystery of really what's going on when we talk about timelines. It's almost as if the Almighty, Almighty God, is imagining multiple versions of the same event into existence simultaneously. But with the kind of variance that we experience when we go back and remember some event or a period of our lives. Let's say we think about a vacation we went on 20 years ago. Well, every time we think about it, it actually is sort of re-scripted in our mind. And I think the same thing is going on at the quantum level. That's what we found, at least, during those exercises.
Well, if they're doing time travel experiments and they've sent people to this time, how do we still not know? Why has somebody not gone back to get the detailed experience of what occurred and to know for a fact that it was John Wilkes Booth in that booth shooting the president?
Well, that would be technology dependent. What I'm addressing is the chronovisors they were sending me to. Actually, they shut down time travel to the past involving children for that reason. Because while it was gathering intelligence, it wasn't reliable intelligence, at least using the chronovisors. That's all I was involved in relative to the shooting of Abraham Lincoln. So I don't know if later in the program, for example, they sent somebody back via teleportation. But then again, if they did that, if they used Tesla teleportation, that was one of the forms of time travel technology that you needed the technology to get back. In the case of Chronovision, the hologram simply collapsed and we were back. So it would be difficult to send somebody there via a more reliable method like Tesla teleportation because there weren't any Tesla teleporters in 1865, and that particular chrononaut would be stranded there. So those were some of the technical constraints on getting reliable intelligence.
Well, would they be stranded there? Because, I mean, would you need one on the other end, like a telephone receiver? Would you need one there in order to open up the wormhole in that area?
No.
Or could they just send you to a location where there did not, there wasn't required to have a receiver on the other end?
In the case of Tesla teleportation, somebody simply has to jump through the Tesla energetic array across which a curtain of radiant energy is being broadcast. And that will open up a vortal tunnel in time-space and deposit that person in the past or the future. The constraint was that if the device deposited the person to a time before the advent of that technology, they were stranded there. We were using Chronovision because in that case, the device was recapitulating the event. We were being enveloped by the hologram and experiencing the event. And then when the hologram collapsed, we found ourselves back on the stage in 1971, the stage of the chronovisor. So whether you can get back or not is technology dependent. And the constraint was that some of the most reliable forms of quantum access, like physically teleporting somebody to location, could not be used to investigate the period before the advent of the technology.
Bill, I know that you had interest in some of this topic with Andrew Bishago and his claims as well, and had some questions of your own. So as this is a roundtable discussion, we're all chiming in. I'd like to know what your thoughts and position is on somebody that makes claims of being part of the time travel community.
Andy, how were you recruited for this program? What did the people in charge of this program say to you, to your parents? How did they round up the children for these experiments?
Well, that's a little bit murky, but I can give you some clues as to what happened. In other words, by what happened, we can maybe divine why I was selected. First of all, this was an era in which individuals in the executive branch, the intelligence community, and the military were volunteering their children into secret defense projects when children were needed. Children were needed for a variety of reasons by Project Pegasus, primarily because the holograms generated by the chronovisors were collapsing when larger people, namely adults, were used. Now, I was the fifth child of my father, Raymond Francis Bushago, a special projects engineer for the Ralph M. Parsons Company of New York and then later Pasadena, California. My dad was the point man on teleportation between Parsons and the CIA. He was conversant with the theory and practice of Tesla teleportation because he had reperformed Tesla's 1899 teleportation experiments when my dad was employed at the Thomas A. Edison Research Labs in West Orange, New Jersey, from 1956 to 64. So by the mid-60s, when Project Pegasus was launched by DARPA, with Parsons being the primary defense contractor involved, my dad was one of the experts on Tesla teleportation within the defense technical community that included companies like Parsons. So I was born of my father, and part of my selection was undoubtedly based on that. When they began testing children around the country on Project Talent, looking for children of extraordinary IQ, psychic ability, and leadership potential, I scored very high, particularly on IQ and on psychic ability with some leadership ability. And so I basically tested out, and I went through literally hundreds of hoops. I jumped through hundreds of hoops to ultimately time travel for Project Pegasus. I was being sat at a table for hours in the second grade completing survival games, what you would do in the field if you found yourself in trouble. So I was simply jumping through a series of hoops. And then there's also the question of whether or not, because Project Pegasus was in contact with project personnel in the far future, namely in the year 2045, whether I was sort of solipsistically included because I was historically known in the future to have been a participant as a result of speaking and writing about my experiences. I don't know what the ultimate reason was, but I do know that as a result of continuing to jump through these various qualifying hoops, that I ultimately literally went down the rabbit hole of applied time travel and was not just involved with what I was initially involved in, which was remote viewing for the Office of Naval Intelligence. I was in the cadre of children that was asked to identify whether Lieutenant John McCain was in the Hanoi Hilton, the POW compound in North Vietnam, known as the Hanoi Hilton, and if so, where he was in the building. So we were doing actual military remote viewing activities for the Navy, and then that led on to actual time travel in the field.
Is there an inherent danger physically or mentally to making that leap, either through teleportation or through time travel? Does it have an effect on the physicality of the human form?
Well, it certainly has a deracinating psychological effect, and that's another reason why they were using children. They were finding that when they would train, for example, adult Navy enlisted personnel, that they were essentially losing their minds as a result of moving between timelines, literally time traveling. In terms of the physical dangers we know about, we know that those who participated in the Tesla teleportation as adults encountered heart valve defects, and in fact, in 1982, my father's mitral valve was replaced with a St. Jude's cuff because of fusing of the tissues of his mitral valve. And even this week, I was dealing with the hospital where he had his open heart surgeries to try to obtain his medical records regarding that defect. I was also briefed in 2003 by Jack Pruitt of Project Pegasus and later the research director for Project Montauk. And Jack informed me that those who were involved in the teleportation exercises as children have been developing a disease that mimics diabetes in adulthood. So at least as of 1970, while we could teleport safely, there were biomedical effects that were serious. So I'm only advocating the use of teleportation for the general public if we can perform the medical experimentation to determine what this does to human anatomy and find ways to prevent heart valve defects, metabolic disruption, and so forth. But there were serious medical consequences. And I think in terms of what I experienced, in terms of the metabolic disruption, Jack Pruitt's son, Glenn, having already died at 700 pounds as a result of his dilemmas with metabolism, is that it affected me severely at the time. In other words, when we would arrive in New Mexico via Tesla teleportation, we were so thirsty that the children were pushing each other away from the water fountain in order to slake our thirst. So there was a serious metabolic effect when we were teleporting, and I think it had later effects in terms of developing metabolic disruption. Fortunately, I've controlled my weight through caloric restriction and through glycemic indexing, and I have not succumbed in the way that one of my fellow child chrononauts, Glenn Pruitt, has. So there were serious biomedical effects, and we have to address those before we mainstream this technology.
Andy, what about psychological trauma? Was that an issue in Project Pegasus with some of the child chrononauts?
I myself had psychological counseling because I began to develop existential panic attacks as a result of the fear of not getting home, the fear of being stranded in time. When Jack Pruitt trained us in summer of 70 to begin teleporting as a group of children, I had previously jumped back and forth a few times with my father in 68, 69, but in summer of 70, when we were all being trained as a group, he actually gave us an emergency protocol of what to do if, for example, we jumped through the Tesla teleporter in New Jersey in 1971, and it was 1791 in Santa Fe. They were literally training us about what to do if we were stranded in time. And that training activity never really left my mind. So by 1972, when we were taking the Stargate at Cerritos to 2045, I was developing substantial existential fear of not getting home, and I actually had some sort of philosophical counseling about how to cope with those thoughts, and I remained in the program. But yes, it was at times awe-inspiring, but also at times terrifying, because I realized how serious what we were doing was, that we were literally being moved around in time, and that was a fearsome thing to cope with as an 8, 9, 10, 11-year-old.
Joel, I know we have very little time left in this segment. Did you have a question for Andy that you wanted to get to before we wrap up?
Yeah, I have a quick one. I've always had this strange sensation that I was around the Ford Theater at the time President Lincoln was killed. Now, I've never analyzed it quite to the depth that Andrew has, but is it possible that what I'm recalling really took place? Because I'm telling you, the detail is so specific and so realistic that the first time I went there, I could tell the smell of what happened in 1865. It actually smelled different to me. And I was panicked because all I can remember is that I was running through the streets and people were screaming, "The president is dead, the president is dead, President Lincoln has been killed." And I was running through the streets as a little kid, 1865, but in a total panic to get home to what was apparently a rooming house that my parents must have run, because that's all I can remember. Is it possible to remember something that way? Because I have no idea where it would have come from otherwise. I didn't read about it before then. I don't know where it originated.
Perhaps you were there as a child in a past life. That sounds more of a reincarnational memory. I can tell you I did hear the shot several times, and I did hear and see the bedlam that transpired in the theater, and it was
right.
Awful. People were weeping, screaming, and even breaking right. Chairs against the wall and that sort of thing. The crowd just lost it. But I never got up. My mission was to go behind their seating and see who shot the president. And I went up there each of the five or six times I was sent, and I was either the door was locked or I was chased away by a guard or nobody was there and I'd gotten there too early. So they were unable to put me right there so I could see who shot Mr. Lincoln. But it was an awful thing to experience. A couple of the anomalies, in addition to the anomaly of small details of the basic event always changing, but the same basic event sort of being deeply embedded in the quantum hologram, an anomaly that occurred to me is, on one of my first jumps, I looked over on my right, and I thought I was viewing myself in a long hallway mirror, but then the version of myself that I was looking at then deviated to the right, and I realized I was looking at a version of myself from a later jump. On one of the last jumps that I did to Ford's Theater on April 14th of 1865 in the evening, I looked over on my left, and I saw the other complement of that singular event where they had sent me twice to the same evening on the same timeline. So that's the nature of time travel to the past. You don't become yourself. You see yourself, or you meet yourself.
Right.
And that happened in two times I was sent, but it was a singular event. I was just seeing either side of it, as it were.
We have about a minute and a half left. Is that, Bill, are you the one that had a question follow-up?
Yeah, I had one question for both Joel and Andrew, but...
Well, I'll tell you what, we're at the top of the hour. Let's do this. Andrew, could you stay for one more quick segment when we come back?
Sure.
All right, stay tuned. We've got more. Andrew Bishago, our guest. Check out his website, projectpegasus.net. That's projectpegasus.net. And in the next hour, we'll be joined by remote viewer Paul Smith, as well as our guests, William J. Burns and Joel Martin. This is the best in overnight talk radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM.